From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Today we'll talk about the new massive spending plan for schools approved last night by the State House.
This addresses gaps between districts. It doesn't address gaps between students.
Then a conversation with Detroit native, activist, and creator Dream Hampton.
I think that I just do the work that's in front of me and hope that it pays the bills. And if it doesn't, then I just don't have cable. You know, like, I'm a working class girl from the east side of Detroit, so I probably don't need as much money as Denzel does, you know, to live.
And we'll get you ready for cuisine over campfire.
Any sauce is a multi-tool. If you're in Michigan too, don't forget that, like, on your drive to the campsite, you're probably going to run into a lot of farm stands where you can get corn on the cob and other good veggies.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Later on the show, we'll find out how you can elevate your camping cuisine this summer.
Don't forget that, like, on your drive to the campsite, you're probably going to run into a lot of farm stands where you can get corn on the cob and other good veggies.
That's later on the show. But first, the State House passed a spending plan that boosts the K-12 school aid fund by an eye-popping 8%. It also creates a base payment to districts of $8,700 per student. The school's budget was approved nearly unanimously in the State House and now goes to the Senate. But the timing is important because school budget cycles begin on July 1st. Here to parse out the massive spending plan is Brian Gutman with advocacy firm Education Trust Midwest. Brian, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me again.
So can you tell me, what does this spending plan mean for school districts if enacted?
Yeah, so if enacted, I think one really important thing is that this is an on-time budget. It provides certainty to schools before their fiscal years go into place at the beginning of next month about what resources they will actually have to spend. We've heard a lot from schools over the years about just how difficult the budget cycles not matching up are, particularly during these last couple years when there have been so many questions about what spending is actually going to look like. So it provides some certainty. That's a really important start. And it's due to leaders on both sides of the aisle putting aside political differences and really delivering a budget for students in schools first. And that's something that we should be celebrating.
You know, I think the legislature, though it's had some bobbles along the way, has gotten much better about getting spending plans to schools earlier than maybe they used to a decade ago or so. We are in an incredibly divided time in government. Do you find it surprising that they are able to get this close to a plan?
It makes me optimistic. At the end of the day, I was struck at how close the House plan was to some of the priorities that the governor laid out. And it does make me optimistic that we can have our differences, we can have our debates at the state policy level, and ultimately make sure that, and you're right, in the last decade, most of the budgets have been delivered on time or early, and be able to provide that certainty, and be able to provide, in many cases, funding and policy changes that really are intended to focus on students first.
So let's talk a little bit about the funding portion of it. We're talking about a per pupil funding structure of about $8,700 per student and an 8% increase overall in spending for the school aid fund. Can you tell me how this would be landing on districts and how it would be received if it goes through?
If this goes through, everybody has something to gain, and you know, that makes celebrating a budget a little bit easier. But the reality is it's taken a long time to get here on the foundation allowance, and we've got a whole lot further to go. So as you may recall, that common foundation allowance, which is likely to be talked about a lot, is almost 30 years in the making. This has been a goal of Proposal A from the early 1990s. What it doesn't do is it doesn't base funding on the needs of students. And we really can't afford another 30 years of waiting for students to actually be funded based on their needs. If this proposal or something very similar to it goes into effect, we really need to pivot. And we really need to focus on making sure that regardless of where a student enters into the school system, regardless of what their needs are, that we're funding those needs so that they have meaningful access to opportunity, so that they truly have the supports they need to succeed. Michigan has a long, long way to go on that front.
So you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm hearing is this goes a long way to correct for some gaps, but it doesn't address issues of equity in funding and equity in education.
This addresses gaps between districts. It doesn't address gaps between students and student needs. Our students don't have the time. We can't see another three generations of students start and finish school before we finally start focusing on what does it actually take to educate the student who's entering the classroom.
Is what you're talking about something that could be addressed in a funding model, or would it have to be addressed on the policy side?
It can be addressed in a number of different ways, and we have some mechanisms already in place. So, for example, this budget nearly doubles funding for English learners. It nearly doubles funding for young children 0 to 3 with disabilities through the Early On program. Those are really important starts. It slightly increases at-risk funding, which is used to help support the additional learning needs of students from low-income families, foster-involved youth, and homeless students. But that funding isn't nearly enough to actually meet their needs. And so as the state moves forward, it's going to be increasingly important that we utilize additional future funding to really focus first on the unmet needs of underserved students in this state.
Could we go back for a moment, Brian, and revisit Proposal A, what it did to funding and how this maybe makes up for some of that?
Sure. So Proposal A, which again, nearly 30 years ago passed, really pivoted the state from funding school districts based on primarily property taxes and property values to our current system. Most of our school money comes from state sales tax. And the goal at the time was to take large gaps that existed in school district funding levels and to close them. And frankly, if that's your goal, there's been a lot of success, and this budget is the last step in that process, where school districts would receive a common base funding of $8,700. Again, it took a long time to get there, and it addressed the gap between school district funding. It wasn't designed and hasn't addressed the gap between unique student needs.
Mm-hmm. So which districts would arguably walk away happiest?
Yeah, so the reality is that the vast, vast majority of Michigan school districts were funded this year at the lower base funding level. So it brings them up. We're somewhere in the range of about 85% of districts that are receiving that common funding level. You have a handful of districts who are outside of Michigan's formula. But really, what we've seen over the last three decades is this leveling of funding between school districts to close what used to be pretty significant gaps. And that has largely been resolved over many, many budgets, including this most recent budget that's now up for Senate consideration.
Do you expect the Senate will get on board with it, even though there's no indication yet that they are going to approve it? Just given the time crunch, do you think the pressure will create enough of an incentive to pass this budget?
I think that there's a lot in this budget that reflects broad priorities. Certainly we've seen in the House, and it was, I don't recall a budget passing with as much bipartisan support as this one did.
I know.
And I think it is likely that the eventual Senate budget will probably include many of the, many if not all of the key components of this budget. We've talked a lot about the foundation allowance. There are some other really important funding needs met in this budget. I mentioned funding for young students with disabilities. There's also additional special education costs provided and bilingual education. We've also seen things that are going to be really important given the nature of the pandemic. So things like additional wraparound services to support physical and mental health needs of students, attendance recovery to make sure that kids who have disengaged are having services that are intended to re-engage them. Things like funding for early literacy and early learning programs that have been such a long time focus for the state. There's a number of priorities that are prominent in this budget that I think are broadly reflective of where elected leaders on both sides of the aisle are. So it makes me hopeful that the Senate will pass a budget that accomplishes many of these priorities on time.
So, Brian, this incredible boost in funding comes as the result of a windfall from the federal government with COVID-19 relief funds. So is this model or this presentation of how schools might be funded sustainable going forward, or is this something where we will just go back in a year or 3 years and find ourselves in the same predicament we were, 3 years ago?
You know, we do tend to have this conversation when federal dollars are involved. Is this sustainable or not? And I think I would look to the broad picture of Michigan's budget, not only this slice of the pie. At the end of the day, our lawmakers are being asked to set priorities. Are they prioritizing the common foundation allowance? Are they prioritizing the needs of the student in the classroom? Are we funding prisons or are we funding schools? There are many, many needs, of course, throughout state government. Ultimately, these spending levels are sustainable if public education remains a priority. And that's with or without the additional federal dollars. There is some additional federal money that hasn't been spent. And that provides a real opportunity for state leaders to go beyond the bounds of this budget and really invest in systemic improvements that focus on how we help the most vulnerable students, the most underserved students, be supported, particularly following a year of a year and a half of pandemic education and very different schooling than we've been used to.
Brian Gutman is a director with the Education Trust Midwest. Brian, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Earlier this year, I spoke with activist and creator Dream Hampton about her home city of Detroit, her work, and a new role on the board of the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. The museum on Woodward experienced a sort of reckoning this past year, tackling curator accusations of racism and discrimination from a former director. It's a subject Dream Hampton is perhaps uniquely gifted to take on. Here's our conversation. Dream Hampton, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So it occurred to me that you're joining MOCAD makes perfect sense, as your career has been what seems to be this perfect symbiotic relationship between art and activism. Can you talk about how you've been able to strike the balance between those two, and if ever one has been the leader over the other?
Yeah, I mean, great question, because the truth is there isn't really balance. They're two beyond full-time jobs. They take up, both of them, 200% of your time. And so there have been absolute gaps when I look at my life, and which is also my career. I don't know that there's a big distinction. I kind of do what I love, and therefore it's my life. And there are whole years when all I was doing, even recently, I was living in Los Angeles, splitting my time between Los Angeles and Detroit, and I found myself working on two different props, props 47 and 64, and they were my first time doing activism that was connected to actual legislation. One was about changing felonies to the misdemeanors that they should have always been, and the other one was about the legalization and the economic equity issues connected to the legalization of marijuana. And learned so much doing both of those legislations, but I wasn't at that same time also making art. It was when I told my partner in that work, hey, I'm so glad we got these two props passed. I need to go and do, some film now, make some art. And then I went and made three film and TV projects, Surviving R. Kelly, one of them. So if I started working on those three films in 2018, I would say from 2014 to 2018, I was just working on legislation. So I don't have a balance. I kind of go in between. It's a toggle.
It's so funny. So the last time I saw you and I was interviewing you just about your career, in the in-between moments while you were waiting for, you know, us to get set up and all of that, I remember you were on a some sort of like activism call, like a, and I was like, oh, how does this woman find the time for all this incredible stuff? But then, you know, it kind of reminds me of Denzel Washington. I once heard him say that, like, he makes the equalizer so that he can make Fences, and that he kind of goes back and forth between the films he wants to make and the films that make him a lot of money so that he can make those films. And do you have to – I mean, when it comes to balance, do you have to kind of strike that balance of doing the things that are meaningful to you and make money but that give you the space to work on things that don't pay the bills at all?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that I just do the work that's in front of me and hope that it pays the bills. And if it doesn't, then I just don't have cable. You know, like, I'm a working class girl from the east side of Detroit, so – I probably don't need as much money as Denzel does, you know, to live. And I also have realized, just thinking how quickly time has passed, I realize how short life is. And so when you do something that has some success, like Surviving R. Kelly, and I did, again, three projects that year, two of which I'm very proud of, but hardly anyone saw. So you have this one project out of three that people saw, and it gets you all these meetings. I don't then look at those these new opportunities as, you know, what's going to be my payday and what's going to be what I care about. Because I think that life is short, I'm only going to do the stuff that I care about. I grew up in Detroit when, like, a lot of my friends were dealing drugs. They had a ton of money. So I've been in every fancy car you can be in. So I don't need a fancy car. I have a Volkswagen. I don't know. I'm okay.
So when we're talking about things that you make space and time for, regardless of you know, the payday. When it comes to then MOCAD and taking this on, what are you hoping to bring to the board or to help shift at MOCAD?
Well, I mean, first of all, I was actually honored. I know this sounds like something that people say, but I was super honored to be invited. I love what they have been trying to do there. And for me, that reach can be just as important as whether or not they reach their goal, you know? I've seen them bring in amazing people as curators. One of the very first shows that I saw there, Visions in a Cornfield, blew my socks off. It's definitely one of the best shows I've seen in the past 10, 15 years. And I remember them also making missteps from the beginning. Remember they had that sign, you were probably still at WDET and had to pass it every day, that said, mm-hmm. nothing is going to be all right or something.
It's like, it's all going to be all right or, yeah.
No, it was nothing is going to be all right.
Is that right?
It was the first sign. Yeah. And so Community was like, are you friggin' kidding me? We don't need your your dystopic irony or your Tim Burton vibes. So they changed it. They changed the sign. And I remember being, wow, they were actually responsive to Community. I'm not sure that would have happened in New York. New York would have just kept on being, you know, droll and ironic or whatever they were going for. And so, you know, that kind of responsiveness to Community, I'm not saying it's always been there. I'm not saying they've always met community demands. And I'm not saying that my joining the board is going to improve that, but it'll be one of the things as a board member that I'm looking at is how, as you build an institution in Detroit, which MOCAD is certainly going to be, how can you be accountable to community?
Dream, you became a national name with your byline on some really big profiles of rappers in the mid-1990s, and you also counted some of hip-hop's biggest names as colleagues or friends at the time. I've been thinking about you a lot lately because I realized for myself that it's a lot harder for me to listen to hip-hop and rap that I used to love because the messages are so dismissive of women. I find myself now searching for more empowered female MCs in a way that I never did maybe 5 or 10 years ago. Do you reflect differently on the art of people who you came up with, whose messages you don't always love?
Well, I mean, I'm proud to say that I handled it then. you know? It's not an afterthought for me. I was self-identifying as a feminist by the time I started doing that work at 19. I'd already, you know, begun reading bell hooks and been thinking about misogyny and art, and whether I'm looking at Picasso's work where he's literally rearranging women that he's also in real life terrorizing, or I'm looking at, you know, Treat Her Like a Prostitute by Slick Rick, an MC that I love. Tribe Called Quest, their date rape song. I remember us taking on a Tribe Called Quest back in the day. I mean, the first thing I ever wrote at the Source, for instance, when I was 19, was an article about Dr. Dre physically assaulting Dee Barnes. And I had death threats from death row. So I think that, you know, one of the things that's been amazing about Me Too is to learn, you know, yes, like maybe this is starts with some Hollywood women sharing their stories, and maybe those Hollywood women are only B-list, and then the A-listers like Gwyneth and Angelina come out. And then immediately there was this pivot that I was grateful that Time's Up did, you know, to say janitors in California. And so what we learned from Me Too in those early days of the hashtag and people using that hashtag to nest their own testimonies around trauma and just everyday misogyny, casual or violent, all of it is violent, but casual or like super, you know, whatever the spectrum would be, we found that it's everywhere. You know, that is actually the story of Me Too. But what we learned early in Me Too is that we don't have to look at something as outrageous as hip hop or rock and roll. We could obviously do the same thing with music from any genre in the 80s and 90s. You could find misogyny. But we can look at it in every aspect of our life, which I knew then too. You know, I knew that the first time that I heard that women were bitches and hoes wasn't on a Snoop Dogg record, but it was in church, where I learned the binary of Madonna and the whore.
That's so interesting. So how do we determine what is a forgivable sin, maybe, of an artist versus a transgression that's so egregious that we have to, like, completely cleanse ourselves of the art as well? On that extreme, R. Kelly would be a pretty great example, although many people have not cleansed themselves of his art. How do you make that distinction?
Yeah, it's hard for me. I love R. Kelly's music, so I get it. I'm not here to be the referee around that. I included the women who began the Mute R. Kelly campaign in the documentary, but I didn't start the Mute R. Kelly campaign. I'd already failed back then that, you know, very young dream who was reading Pearl Clegg, of course, from Detroit, playwright and author. Her father was Reverend Clegg, who started the Shrine of the Black Madonna, and she wrote an incredible kind of chap-sized book called Mad at Miles, when Quincy Troops' Miles Davis autobiography came out, and he was gleefully or just completely unrepentantly talking about physically abusing women like Cicely Tyson. And what Pearl Clegg was calling for in the book Mad at Miles, it was about boycotting his music. And when you have someone like R. Kelly, who, when you buy his concert ticket or when you are supporting his music with money, you are helping to tie women to radiators, then there's something that you can do about it, you know? I also think that there's, you know, Detroit has been leading in terms of social justice, leading practices around restorative justice and transformative justice. And I think those are important too, you know? I remember calling in Too Short instead of calling him out. He'd made some ridiculous video for some rap site about how to corner a girl on the playground and smooch her booty. It was like an instruction video for eighth grade boys on how to sexually assault their classmates. And I got him on the phone and just, you know, kind of went in on him for like an hour. And he just really didn't even understand that what he was describing was sexual assault. And he wasn't young. This is like, you know, 10 years ago.
He saw it as something like playful interactions between boys and girls.
Yeah. And I had to let him know what it was like going to public pools, like growing up in Detroit, you know, being at Chandler Park or Belle Isle, and, you know, what was considered playful and what was absolutely sexual assault, you know? And so, you know, we had that conversation, and that I'm not saying the too short is some changed man or that calling him in was better than calling him out. I published that article, so it was a call in and call out at the same time. I too have been, you know, there's a whole new generation that calls things abuse that I didn't consider abuse before. And I have been called out in that way. I haven't been called in. With this generation, you learn about it when people post about it. They don't like come to you directly. They're like conflict averse and then they blow up on the internet. But even that model of never having someone come to you with their problems about you has still been instructive to me. I've still been able to learn things. Once you get past the ego bruising of being called out, then you have to look at the charges and then separate things that you can't own to things that you can and then work on them.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking now with Dream Hampton. She's a Detroit native, a filmmaker, an art and culture critic, a woman of many hats, I would say. So let's talk a little bit about then Detroit Narrative Agency, the idea of disrupting harmful narratives about Detroit, a community of filmmakers doing this. What are the most harmful narratives that you'd like to eradicate as a filmmaker?
I think that some of them sound benign, you know. My work isn't necessarily completely focused in Detroit. Of course, Treasure was a documentary that I did about Shelley Hilliard. But the work of Detroit Narrative Agency was thinking about things that, again, seemingly benign as Detroit is back, you know, which is why you see people wearing T-shirts that said Detroit never left. Because implicit in all of those conversations, like everything with Detroit, is this weird race, you know, this narrative that now that white people are moving back to the city, it's somehow back, that everything in between was this dead space. And Detroit in the 80s, there's nowhere else I'd rather be. It was incredibly vibrant. I felt powerful. I remember moving to New York in 1990 and bemoaning the lack of like black civic leadership. I remember David Dinkins in my second year in New York was up for mayor, and everyone was so excited that they were getting to vote for the very first time in New York's history for a black mayor. And I'm like, what? Like, that's all we have in Detroit, until, of course, we didn't. And so, you know, I remember feeling quite empowered growing up in Detroit. And in the absence of, like, you know, being in an all-black city meant that in the absence of that kind of racial discord, I mean, you can find some racial discord, you just had to go to the suburbs to do it. We had to deal with stuff like class, you know, like, again, when I say I'm from the East Side, that means something. It means that I'm from, like, the poorest neighborhood, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the country. And when I went to Cass Tech, all of a sudden I was in school with people whose parents were lawyers and doctors or engineers at Chrysler. And then I just realized, you know, something that, you know, Americans never want to deal with, which is like a class conversation. And so, I don't know, that's one thing about Detroit. Detroit is back, has implicit in it, and DNA, you know, knows this and identifies it and talks about it in their work when they do presentations as a collective of their films. And their films don't necessarily deal with issues like gentrification, but the need to create a Detroit narrative agency was to push back against Detroit as a blank slate, Detroit as a city where other people needed to drop in, whether it was someone from Time magazine or the filmmakers who made that wonderful film, Jesus Camp, and then came to Detroit and made a not so great film. You know, just the whole kind of like parachute in because there's no one there to tell their own stories, which was never true. We've always been a city of storytellers and artists.
Right. So you're in the city of Detroit now, and as you've mentioned, you have spent the past few years splitting your time between various cities, including Los Angeles, and I'm sure New York in there as well, if not other cities to do your film projects. What keeps you coming back to the city of Detroit?
Well, I made a real decision to come home in about 07, 08. My daughter was about to be an age where she would, if we were living in Detroit or the Midwest, be learning how to drive. And we weren't. We were living in New York where people at 50 years old don't know how to drive. So I remember thinking something as random as that. Like, I really want my kid to have a Midwestern, you know, kind of teenage years. They can get super fast in New York. And so I made a decision to come home. Family stuff also brought me home. And I guess that's the bottom line. This is my home. And so when I think about the kind of childhood that I want to give my daughter, when I think about having to be close to family, you know, which isn't always, a lot of us, you know, particularly artists, you flee your hometown and your family, you know, they don't understand you and this place is too small for me. but then you, it's like, you know, it's like the White Stripes' little room, you know, you like, you're sitting there, you're dealing with whatever amount of success that you have. And you're like, wait, how do I get back to that thing that made me fresh or that made me me? And for me, that's Detroit. And so I'll always come home to Detroit, you know.
Dream Hampton is an Emmy-nominated filmmaker and the newest member of the board of MOCAD. Dream, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Baer. Ocean swimming can be dangerous, and many beaches have lifeguards at the ready. But that's not the case for most beaches along the Great Lakes. After a record number of drownings on Lake Michigan last year, one city in Michigan is getting creative with its water rescues. Interlochen Public Radio's Dan Winchura reports.
I'm on the pier at South Haven, which sits right on the shores of Lake Michigan. The city has two main public beaches and a popular lighthouse, an idyllic setting that attracts tens of thousands of tourists every summer. But swimming here can be dangerous because of rip currents and strong waves, and swimmers who are unfamiliar with them can get in trouble.
It's the out-of-town people who come here on vacation and things like that that we need to work on educating, and that's been a bit of a challenge and had to do some outside-of-the-box thinking for that.
Zachary Kenrich is a paramedic with South Haven Area Emergency Services. Last year, his team responded to 23 water rescues on Lake Michigan. Three people drowned. That's when Kenrich started brainstorming on ways his department could cut down on its response time for people struggling in the water. And what he came up with was this. Thanks to a $7,500 grant, the department was able to buy a special drone outfitted with some unique features. It's about the size of a Frisbee and is equipped with a camera. Dangling from the center of it is a small, folded-up flotation device, which can be released remotely by the drone operator.
And I can drop it, like that.
Once it hits the water, a CO2 canister automatically inflates into a 3-foot-by-6-inch yellow flotation tube, big enough to support an adult. Drones dropping inflatables have been popular in Australia for a few years now. And this year, some beaches in California and Florida are also starting to deploy them.
We have tested it multiple times. It's been working very well for us. And this doesn't change anything that we do normally.
But not everyone is gung-ho about using these drones. Dave Benjamin heads the Great Lakes Surf Rescue Project, a water safety nonprofit group.
This inflatable device would almost literally have to be dropped on their head or in their hands.
If it's not, the victim might not be able to reach the flotation device, or waves could carry it to shore without them. Still, in South Haven, it normally takes emergency responders around 8 minutes to get from the station to the beach and then to the victim in the water. That's pretty quick, but sometimes every second counts, and the drone can get help to the swimmer faster. It can fly up to 40 miles per hour and can reach a victim about 3 minutes quicker. Last year, there were 56 drownings in Lake Michigan, the most on record.
It is a quick way to get a flotation device out to a victim, and it's very important that that is done as quickly as possible.
BJ Fisher is the Director of Health and Safety at the American Lifeguard Association. He says integrating more technology into these rescue operations is a good thing, but installing more lifeguards at beaches would still be the best option. But that's a challenge for tourist cities like South Haven, which face staffing shortages and have liability concerns about using lifeguards.
It won't solve the problem, but it's better than nothing.
With July right around the corner, more and more people are going to be getting in the Great Lakes. For the emergency services team here in South Haven, they hope this new drone means fun days at the beach won't turn tragic. I'm Dan Wanchura.
That story was featured recently on Interlochen Public Radio's weekly podcast, Points North. So you waited all year to reserve that perfect campsite, and you're in. Soon enough, you're packing the tent, sleeping bags, and bug spray. Now comes the fun part, planning what you're going to eat all weekend. Bon Appetit's June-July issue has some tips, gear, and recipe ideas for cooking while camping so you can sit back around the campfire and enjoy the outdoors. April Baer recently spoke with Bon Appetit's senior staff writer, Alex Beggs. Here's their conversation.
Hey, Alex. Happy summer.
Hey, April. Good to hear from you.
What are some common mistakes you think people make when they're packing food for camping? I myself have this habit of bringing way too much. Are there any other rookie blunders you can steer us away from?
I think bringing too much is a good thing, first of all, but because you definitely don't want to have not enough. But I think the biggest I can think of many mistakes because they're all mistakes I've made, like forgetting to bring trash bags. But I think a big one is bringing food that you would normally never eat. So if you walk into REI and you see the array of like dehydrated mush type foods and stuff that's like for serious backpackers and people who appear to be going into space, don't get that. That is depressing, flavorless, boring food. And so I think that that's a mistake. I think not seeing this as an opportunity to be like fully on vacation and eating the foods you want to eat on vacation is usually how I try and approach it. So like, you know, stocking up on fancy cheeses, which doesn't seem like it would make sense in the woods, but is in fact one of the best things to eat by the campfire. I think another one is bringing Trek mix that doesn't have M&Ms in it. You know, like you're like, oh, I'm going to go for the healthy one that doesn't. Don't, what? You're camping. We have a really good recipe for these trail mix cookies. I like to bring those. And then I think another one is what I am obliged to say as a lover of the state and national parks, which is don't leave a mess. That's definitely the biggest mistake.
I checked out the trail mix cookie recipe, and I just like to say I hope I don't have to go camping to wait to make that. They sound amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it works for all occasions. I eat them for breakfast when we're camping because it has a, you know, dried fruit in it. It's like several food groups. Even if you put chia seeds, I mean, it's like half your daily fiber right there.
Nice. Camp kitchen setup can be pretty elaborate. I tend to find myself trying to strip it down and take as little as possible. But there's at the same time, there's some really fun gear. I like taking a small cast iron skillet out. They're so all-purpose. Do you have any tips for making sure you've got the right kitchen equipment in your kit?
Yeah, I think it depends on kind of what you're cooking. A lot of people love cooking with a cast iron when they're camping. I don't. It just is heavy and I don't like doing dishes. So I tend to eat a lot of foil pack meals and things that we put directly on the grill. So I think the gear is kind of whatever you're excited about because, yeah, there is endless gear and it's really fun and you can end up spending a lot of money on stuff you'll never use. But, you know, you can sell it at a garage sale later. So just get what you want. But my favorite thing is, I think it's fairly new. It's this brand called Breo, B-R-E-E-O, and they make a portable grill. So it's sort of like the grill grate on a stick that you can adjust the grill up and down. So if you're at a campsite that just has a fire pit and no grill grates or no grill whatsoever, you bring that, you stick it in the ground, and we cook everything over that, whether we're boiling water for coffee or we did chicken wings right over the campfire on it. So that's my favorite thing. And the other gear I really love is not necessarily a cooking tool, but having these, there are a lot of new side tables that pack up into these really lightweight little bags, and having a side table, I think Helinox is the brand that makes the one I have and love, is awesome, you know, for your drinks and for that very important cheese plate I'm bringing for some reason. And you have an extra table space, I think, so you don't have to put everything on your cooler. So I love those and have a couple of those. Big fan of the camping side table if you don't have a handy stump around.
Can you explain the foil pack formula that you referenced? This is such a brilliant idea, especially if you're feeling nervous about a lack of control over how big your fire is going to get.
Yeah, that's definitely another cooking mistake, is when the fire is roaring and people are like, okay, we're going to cook over this now. No, don't do that. Everything is going to char. But with foil packs, Anyone who's in the Boy Scouts probably knows what I'm talking about. That was not me. But you have a sheet of heavy-duty foil, not the regular foil because that might tear open, which would be tragic. And in the middle of the foil, I do a layer of a vegetable. So in the spring, because I work at Bon Appetit, when I went camping, we did ramps on the bottom and then a piece of salmon on top and then butter that I had doctored up with other stuff. I think I put anchovies and herbs and red chili flakes in the butter. I made this ahead of time. And plop that on top of the salmon, wrap it all up. I sort of wrap it like a napkin, you know, like napkin swans. And so the edges of the foil curve up. So you got a little handle. Drop that in the side of the fire, like the coals, you know, off to the side where it's hot but not crazy. And it can be ready in like 10 minutes. It's so fast because the fish steams. Everything is steaming in there, getting so tender and juicy. It's less likely to overcook that way. And then you can eat it right on your lap. So you don't have pots. You don't have plates. You still might need a fork unless you're like totally barbaric. And then I might bring a sliced up lemon if I planned that ahead of time well enough.
That sounds so good.
So yeah, that's my favorite thing to do. But you can put anything in the foil pack. My sister camps a lot, and she does sausage and peppers and onions, which I feel like is very classic. But you can get creative as long as everything in the pack kind of cooks at the same time. So big potatoes take forever to cook, so don't put those in there.
Or at least cut them small. That's the only way to mm-hmm. go. Yeah. Alex, do you ever do any foraging when you're out in the woods?
It's funny that you ask because I just noticed that I have a ton of milkweed growing in my yard in Ann Arbor, and I got a foraging book online because I want to figure out how to eat it. I think you just cook it like asparagus or something, but I haven't done that while camping because if I accidentally poison myself, you know, like who's going to save you out there?
Right.
so I don't mess with that, but I appreciate people who make it their life's work to do so.
Yeah. There's something that's always been an issue whenever I've gone camping, and that is I've been sleeping on the hard ground all night. I wake up, and I need caffeine right away. Do you have a recommended method for getting the coffee made in a camp environment, or like what do you drink first thing? Do you just boil it up right over the fire first thing?
This is another thing that I've learned the hard way. The first time we went camping in a long time, we're like, okay, we're going to make French press camping. Simple, you know, it doesn't require a lot of equipment. We have a plastic one, great. But the time it takes to make a fire in the morning and then boil water over the fire, make the French press, and then deal with the grounds if you're at a campsite that doesn't have running water, it was a messy nightmare that took so long that I swore I would never make coffee in any kind of way again while camping. So now we bring cold brew and either heat it up over the fire if it's kind of chilly out in the morning, or drink it straight. And there are a lot of great cold brews out there. So, and you can bring a huge one for a crowd if you have all your friends with you, which I think is the best way to camp with a ton of friends. But there are some really good instant coffees too. At REI, you can buy one called the Alpine Start, and it's really delicious. And, you know, those are easy to pack. And I think they do a instant chai latte as well. So Starbucks has a new instant coffee out. That's my option too. But I'm definitely not getting roped into any elaborate pour over coffee making situation while I'm in the woods. It's too cold for that.
You know, I think I will never drink anything other than cold brew at a campsite again, and something that's made ahead, which brings me to a thread that I find all the way through this issue. And that is that making ahead is definitely the way to go. How do you go about that?
Yeah, it is the way to go if you have the time, which as a 33-year-old childless person, I do. So I don't want to say it's for everyone to make like an elaborate compound butter before you go camping. However, it's not as hard as it sounds, and you should. So I get really excited about camping, and several days before, I will be planning all the things I want to eat and kind of mapping out what I can do ahead. So even if you're just doing hot dogs while you're camping, I make sure to just chop up a ton of white onion the day before and have that ready to go. We have a recipe for Green Goddess tuna salad because you're like, what are we going to do for lunch? And that one is awesome. Bring a ton of English muffins, grill them over the campfire. And then, you know, I think in a moment of rusticness, I was dipping the bread in the tuna salad, but a more civilized person could use a spoon. Another thing we've made ahead were marinated chicken wings, which is fun. And if you want to do breakfast, sometimes I just want honey bunches of oats out of the same mug that I had coffee out of that I will later have wine in. But if you want to make breakfast, crack a ton of eggs into your blender, blend that up, bring the container of eggs ready to go for breakfast tacos or scrambled eggs. That's an easy one to do ahead too. So it's really more of just like planning the meals and doing yourself as many favors as possible before you get out there. Because when you get to your campsite, you want to build a fire and have a drink and read a murder mystery if you're me.
Outstanding. Okay, so there is one final thing that really bedevils me when I'm getting ready, and maybe it kind of brings us back around to the packing too much problem. When I think about going away for even a weekend and planning out every single meal and planning out different things to eat all that time, it just makes my eyes cross. And yet I feel like people, when they're looking to the cook at the campsite, they don't want to necessarily eat, you know, the hot dog every day or like every dinner. As you were thinking about this, did you run across any foods or any ingredients that were sort of multi-tools for the campsite?
Sure. Any sauce is a multi-tool. If you're in Michigan too, don't forget that like on your drive to the campsite, you're probably going to run into a lot of farm stands where you can get corn on the cob and other good veggies. And like all that stuff can get stuck on a, you know, skewer that you're going to have marshmallows on later and grilled. And if you bring this sauce that can do anything, that can kind of change it up from meal to meal, whether it's a garlicky yogurt sauce or jug, which is a spicy herb sauce, or your favorite salsa or Sweet Baby Ray's, you know. So I usually do some sort of butter because I obviously like have a butter fixation right now, but I think that helps. And the other thing to know is that what's really good sometimes when you're camping is cold pizza. I brought leftover cold pizza camping before and was like, this was brilliant doing this every time. Yesterday's like a bucket of fried chicken, also great while you're camping. It doesn't have to be this cooking event if you don't want it to be, or if you want to give yourself a break. That's an option. Don't forget it.
That was my family's go-to growing up in Ohio. The first stop after we left the house was always to Kentucky Fried Chicken so that bucket would be good and cold by the time we got to the campsite.
So good.
But so hard to wait with that smell permeating the entire car.
Yeah. Then there's that.
Alex, you mentioned the joys of campfire drinking. Do you have any favorite cocktails or things that you mix up when you're getting ready to hit the forest?
That should have been the first thing I said when you asked me about make ahead. Because the first thing I make is a Nalgene full of Negronis. And I go through cocktail phases where maybe I'm drinking a lot of Cosmos right now. I made a lot of pina coladas last month. So whatever cocktail phase I'm going through, pre-batch a lot of those. And then you probably have an insulated mug from your work or something with a logo on it that you got for free at an event. Fill that with ice, and that's your cocktail ice. And then you've got your Nalgene full of Negronis. You're set for the whole weekend. So that's my favorite right now. I also, you know, might pre-mix iced tea. Got to have some non-alcoholic options too.
The best things come to those who wait. Take it from Alex Beggs, senior staff writer for Bon Appetit. Alex, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for giving us the skinny on outdoor cooking.
Thanks for having me, April.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you on Monday.